With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know.
And on my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Welcome to Clash of the Titles, the podcast that normally sees two movies with something in common go head-to-head to see which one does it better. But this week is a triple threat week. On this week's episodes, in the red corner, Charlton Heston versus Dr. Zeus. Oh, Dr. Zeus. In 1968's Planet of the Apes.
Discover Planet of the Apes, a civilization where humans run wild in the jungles and the superior beings are apes.
While in the blue corner, Marky Mark is up against Tim Roth's General Thade, who is one angry ape as Tim Burton delivers that twist in 2001's Planet of the Apes.
One day they'll tell a story, and some will say it was just a fairy tale. About a human who came from the stars and changed our world. It's disgusting the way we treat humans.
How the hell did they get like this?
What other way would they be?
If they see you on the street, they kill you on sight.
You stay here, you're already dead.
Which tribe are you from?
United States Air Force. I'm going back. Fine.
Some humans have escaped.
Is there another way out of the city?
I can show you the way.
While in the puce corner, James Franco says, Hail Caesar, as he fiddles with Ape Anatomy from 2011. It's the incorrectly titled Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
We're talking about huge potential for millions of people.
Our therapy enables the brain to repair itself.
We call it the cure.
I want you to start testing on chimps ASAP.
We test one subject. I want to make sure it's stable.
I designed the 112 for repair.
But Caesar's gone way beyond that.
You mean increased intelligence?
The skills that far exceed that of a human counterpart.
So what connects these three films and which one does it better? Let's find out. It's Clash of the Titles.
Release the Kraken!
Hello, Clash Putters. Oh my God. I'm back. I'm home. I'm Alex Zane.
That's excruciating. I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilley.
Hey, Chris Tilley. Chris is recording remotely today. Just to fill you in, Chris, you are being missed. There is a giant hole in the studio this week in your absence. Victoria is wearing a lovely floral summery dress. I'm wearing a black T-shirt and jeans. What are you wearing?
Nothing.
That's uncomfortable.
I knew he was going to say that as well.
I think I knew that as well. I thought I knew that. Well, thanks for joining us, Chris. And it's lovely to have you here. I'm going to be, isn't it weird? Now he's not here. I'm being really polite to him.
Being really nice to him, yeah.
It's so weird.
Yeah.
So weird. All right. So these were Chris's choices this week. Ape on Ape action. Chris, tell us your thought process.
I like Planet of the Apes and I like Rise of the Planet of the Apes. So I thought it would be nice to compare the two of them.
And thrusting that third movie in.
Yeah. And then when I mentioned it to you, we both agreed that we couldn't not discuss the Tim Burton because there's too much going on there to ignore it.
And on a personal level, I wanted to watch the Tim Burton one again. I'd only seen it once and I was like, it can't be that bad. And yeah, we will talk about that on the next episode. Quick question. Probably I should have done this off air, but these episodes are going out Monday, Wednesday, Friday, correct?
No, we do the Monday, Thursday, Saturday is how we've always done it.
Why you need to be here at the studio, Chris? This is what happens when you take a day off. It all goes to pieces. Right, cool. So Monday, Thursday and Saturday. Got it. So on Thursday, we'll be talking about 2001's Tim Burton's reimagining of Planet of the Apes. On Saturday, I'll be talking about 2011's Rise of the Planet of the Apes. But yes, today we are talking about the original 1968 Planet of the Apes. Great clues. Chris, you started us off with a clue last week. What was it?
Guerrilla warfare.
Yeah, nice. Simple. Effective. Then you follow that up on Twitter with
Simpsons line, chimpanzee to chimpanzee.
Great. And over on the Planet of the Crepes on Twitter, it's an amalgamation of Clash Putters and Apes. Crepes.
Okay.
Doesn't work. On Twitter and Instagram, we are at Clash Pod, and we had some guesses crash land. Frank B, Daniel Flynn, Gemma Page, but sadly not her husband, Reese Page, who incorrectly guessed the new Apes trilogy. Paul Logue, Ian Donnarumma, Defias Monk, Liam McPhee, all correctly guessed it, but were beaten to the first guess in. Brand new winner this week. Never won before. I do say that a lot, but this time I'm pretty sure. Wolf35999. Congratulations. Your prize is a VIP night out at Clash Pod's brand new live experience called Chimp Carnage. Two animals enter the arena, one leaves. Our opening night is Wolf versus Chimpanzee. Tickets available right now on our website. If you're sitting on the front row, bring a poncho. Things get messy. Who do you think would win, wolf or chimp? Who's your money on?
A chimp.
You think a chimp would beat a wolf?
Yeah, I do. Chimps are nasty and scary.
This always takes me back to the very first episode we did where, and it genuinely was the first, it was the first episode where you explained at length about that chimpanzee that had been kept as a pet in the US and what it did to the owner. I think I might have edited it out because it was so graphic, your description.
Shall we tell you what it was?
I feel that we've built up enough trust with our listeners now that you can actually can actually do the long form version if you like.
It ripped a woman's face off and then it ripped a man's testicles off.
You didn't need to be asked twice, did you?
No, I love that fact. I mean, it's awful, but bear that in mind.
I just think a wolf, I mean, if it gets the chimp around the neck, this is getting very graphic very quickly, but then you already started with the chimp ripping a man's testicles off. So
you don't give a shit about the woman's face, but the man's balls.
How have you managed to turn it into this?
It's not me.
as a man, I know how it feels to get kicked in the testicles. Right. And so, you know, I guess times that by three or four is what it feels like to get them ripped completely off.
I guess, yeah.
By a chimp.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is what happens when Chris is away. Where are we? Good. Yes, we've no need for a connection section this week, I don't think. Do you want to do one? No. Chris?
No.
No. Right then. Let's get it on. So on Thursday, Chris is dealing with Abraham Lincoln. On Saturday, I'll be planning a chimp-based jailbreak. But today, Vicky wants us to keep our stinking paws off her. V takes on a journey.
Angry chauvinist George Taylor crashes his rocket into the future on a planet where you can breathe the air, walk the terrain and swim the waters, but it's definitely not Earth. Showing fearless leadership skills, he then belittles the surviving crew and sends them on a death march, minus Stuart, the lady astronaut who grew old to death during the crash, thereby dodging a lifetime of sexual slavery at the behest of her, quote, hot and eager colleagues. Taylor ends up in the world's strangest courtroom drama as he discovers this upside-down world is run by apes with a civilization and culture that is just advanced enough to make it possible to film. Finding some comfort in a pet woman and a friendship with Zira and Cornelius, who are pretty chill about cracking wise with the equivalent of a monkey from space, he goes on the run, finds a doll with a battery that's lasted for 800 years, and the freaking Statue of Liberty. Cue massive outpouring of emotion while his pet woman looks on, presumably wondering just how many of her children will be expected to shag their actual siblings in order to repopulate whatever corner of New York her new owner is dragging her to. There you go.
Wow.
Do you think Stuart actually put a hole in her own capsule?
I couldn't believe it.
I mean, I thought that when he was like, yeah, we're very
the
eager.
New Eve.
Very eager. We're gonna be banging away on that. Did she think, fuck this?
No, thanks.
Fuck this. I'm gonna die in my sleep.
Fucking 8 years of astronaut school to end up fucking permanently pregnant and breastfeeding. No, you're all right. I tell you what, just on Stuart. She's only referred to as Stuart in the film and in the credits. And I wanted to find her first name just to do her a favour. So I found it.
Oh.
Where is it? She's called Marianne. But you only find that out on a box set that was released in November 2008. So she's called Marianne Stuart. So there we go. We've done her some justice.
Does it really make up for, you know, killing herself in her sleep to avoid years of sex slavery?
Sexual slavery, honestly. Anyway, So you may be able to tell by my surprise. I've never seen this film. I know it's big, isn't it? It's been a really fun education watching these films, but I'll tell you for why. I just thought it maybe wasn't for me because the jolt that you get when you see a chimp in real life, when you look into its eyes and you're like, oh fuck, they are actually just like us. I get that. But then the minute, so basically I can see why the IP works as a book, but when you put makeup on the monkeys to make them look like human monkeys, but they are humans, I was like, I just don't get that. It just passed me by.
So that's why you didn't watch it.
Because I just thought the makeup will never live up to what you would imagine that to be in your head. I was wrong, but that's why it passed me by.
How often do you find yourself staring into a chimp's eyes?
I mean, probably about once a year, taking the kids to the zoo.
Okay.
Yeah.
And you sort of like, you go off and have fun. Mummy will be by the chimp enclosure.
Just staring at them.
Just peering through the glass.
Mummy wants a new baby. Yeah, I would have a little baby chimp. No, I wouldn't, because it would rip my face off.
Yeah.
Much like a child, actually. So it's all the same. So that's my history. What's yours?
I feel there was a lot of information at the end of that. Yeah. I don't know how to process. You stare at chimps at the zoo going, I want to have a baby with you.
When you see them dressed up as babies, it is cute when they've got little nappies on and stuff. It is.
You see, because I thought the Mark Wahlberg, Helena Bonham Carter romance in 2001's Planet of the Apes was probably going to be the weirdest thing we talked about this week. Yeah. But it turns out actually you relate to that romance between woman and chimp.
No.
Right. You've confused me. Chris, tell me your history with this movie.
I watched it on telly when I was a kid and I loved it. And then I rewatched it about 5 years ago for an article I wrote arguing that rather than Jaws or Star Wars, Planet of the Apes was the original summer blockbuster.
What evidence did you provide in this article? This is a so-called article.
Because it's based on a strong IP. It's a high concept where the story is told in the title. It's got spin-offs in the shapes of TV show, cartoon, audio adventures, Marvel comics. There was merchandise, including trading cards, lunchboxes, costumes, colouring books, early action figures, though they were called figurines at the time. And the big one, it had a whole bunch of sequels that followed. So that's exactly what the modern blockbuster does, and it was doing it 10 years before Jaws and Star Wars.
I mean, it feels petty to get into an argument with you when you're not here, but I thought a summer blockbuster was defined by a wide release, and that's why Jaws is the first summer blockbuster, because they released it on so many screens at exactly the same time, and that is where the term blockbuster comes from.
Depends what your definition is.
The definition of blockbuster.
How about you, Al?
I don't know. It's the answer. This is a really weird one for me. I'm not sure. I've definitely seen part of it, and I don't remember. I've seen it, like, as a kid. I think I put it on, and then I probably left the room because it was really slow as a child, a very slow film. But I definitely seen the monkeys before the apes in the makeup and gone, oh, right. And I definitely remember the bit in the cave at the end and the Statue of Liberty. But again, I told you in the week, I can't remember whether I saw that in the film or I watched it on YouTube just to see the twist, because it was such a cultural touch point. I needed to be aware of what happened in it. So I'm not sure. I've seen bits of it, but no, I've never had the experience of going, as an adult, certainly, watching this and going, oh, wow, Planet of the Apes. This is a cultural touchstone.
I mean, that's the thing. I knew the ending before, because I'd seen it in The Simpsons.
Oh, yeah.
So I knew. So yeah, it's hard to watch, isn't it? Because once you know what's coming, it sort of infects everything else. But yeah.
And arguably, The Simpsons ending is better, where Charlton Heston would have said, I love you, Dr. Zaius.
So I've done quite a lot of research. Would you like to hear some background?
Hell yeah.
Yeah, okay. So it is based on a book by Pierre Boulle from 1963 called La Planète des Songes. He had an interesting life. Did you know he was a spy?
No.
Yeah, he was.
For who? Against who?
He was an agent for the Free French during the Second World War, and he was captured by the Vichy in Indochina. Interesting, isn't it?
That is interesting.
I tell you what's weird. We'll get to this. He was a spy, and then makeup artist John Chambers worked for the CIA.
Holy shit.
I know, it's weird, isn't it?
Wow, that's how I define a blockbuster.
Oh, go fuck yourself.
But anyway, so have you read the book?
No, Chris, have you read the book?
Yeah, I read the book years ago when I was a kid. Just very quickly, the big differences I remember, the protagonist is a journalist called Ulysses.
Yes.
That's different. The ape society is modern, so there's technology and cars and stuff like that. The apes take over by learning to ape humans, is what something that he keeps coming back to.
Is that meant to be a pun as well? They ape humans.
Kind of liked the pun. He liked the pun and he uses it, but he uses it as a device in the book, that they copy humans more and more. And then the ending's different. But we can talk about that, I think, probably on Thursday's episode, because that's more in line with the Tim Burton ending.
Oh, can we do it now? Just, I know you want to talk about it on Thursday and save it, but I'm fascinated by the ending of the book, because I read about what it was and I don't quite understand it, but it does sound like it in some way excuses Tim Burton's insanity.
Well, they're on another planet in the book. They're not on Earth. So they leave the planet, they come back to Earth. He crash lands in France and a policeman shows up, and the policeman is an ape. Mm.
But then aren't the astronauts apes as well?
No, that's the twist.
What's the twist?
The astronauts, it's two people, you think they're people, on honeymoon in space in the book. And the big twist is saved right for the last sentence. She is reading this story about this French person that that found this civilization run by apes. And then she scratches her little fluffy ears and she is an ape. And that's the twist. That's it.
Yeah, I still don't understand it. So wait, so the people in the book who come back to Earth, so the whole thing's
a
story.
Yeah, the whole thing's a story.
Right.
But they are already, so the twist is they're already monkeys, they're already an advanced civilization reading about a Frenchman who found a planet run by monkeys. And then she's like, what a silly story that is. Whatever, but she's a monkey in space. So the truth that was told in the story has already happened, if you know what I mean.
Or never happened because it's just a story.
Yes, but the takeaway of the book is
I'm sorry wanting to learn from you. I thought you love these moments.
Do I? What, these teaching moments? The twist is there is already a civilization advanced enough to have monkeys in space. Yes.
Okay, Tim Burton's version is amazing compared to that.
I've got something on that, because I've read a lot of alternate endings that were written in 1968 for the script, and one of them is basically Tim Burton's ending, apart from Abraham Lincoln, but the planet is run by monkeys.
If you're going to say Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah. So anyway, Arthur P. Jacobs. Now, I read a couple of different things here, so I'll just tell you what I read, because I found more evidence for one version. But I read somewhere that he bought the rights for the novel before it was published, but I also read that it was King Brothers Productions who hired Rod Serling to adapt it, and it was very tricky, and then Arthur P. Jacobs got his hands on it a couple of years later. And I read that a couple of times, so I think I'm going to go with that one, because it was a tricky adaptation, because as we've all said, the apes in the story are really advanced because they're in space and they've got a very advanced futuristic civilization, and it was too expensive to film. So Serling had to reduce it down to its absolute barest components, which is an advanced civilization of apes, but they don't, you know, they're not capable of space travel. He said, as soon as you put a shirt and tie on an orangutan, you invite laughter, but our story is a serious satire, so we had to find a way to handle this properly. So Moore Abrahams, a producer on the film, said that Serling worked on it for 18 months. Then he got busy with something else. So Michael Wilson, who is also a credited writer on this, was hired to do a polish. And then there's another writer, but no one can remember his name. So Moore Abrahams just says, I can't remember his first name, but he did a dialogue polish, but he doesn't get credit for it.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. It's a gutting.
Can you imagine if his contribution was, get your paws off me, you damn stinker?
Yeah, that's true, because it is a dialogue polish. So maybe that's awful, isn't it? So Wilson and Serling share credit, and there has been a bit of debate over the years about who came up with the ending. Moore Abrahams said it was Rod Serling's. I read a lot of alternate endings he did, but Rod Serling, very well known for The Twilight Zone. In 1959, he wrote an episode of The Twilight Zone called I Shot an Arrow into the Air, which has basically got the same ending as Planet of the Apes. So there's that to sort of back up that it was his. It was Michael Wilson's biographer said that it was him, but no one else says that. So let's just go with Rod Serling. So we've got a script. Charlton Heston read from the Serling script with some early version of the makeup to convince Fox that this was a good idea in the first place, because I think it's probably quite a tricky sell, because without the makeup, it's just crackers, this idea that you have to emote, these monkeys have to emote and you have to connect with them, but they're monkey and all the rest of it. Now, this is one of my favourite stories. So for Nova, the mute woman, Ursula Andress and Raquel Welsh turned it down because they were weirdly uninterested in a role that didn't require them to speak at all.
All about face acting, though.
She has to do a lot, yeah.
You rate face acting.
I do rate face
Surely
acting.
Surely it's a challenge.
Yeah, it just seems a bit
she
unbalanced, doesn't it?
She has a man teach her how to smile, which is quite exciting.
Oh my God, yeah. I taught it to smile. It's just unbelievable. it's gossipy, but Linda Harrison got the part. She was in a relationship at the time with the head of the studio, Richard D. Zanuck. She got pregnant during filming, but that's gossipy and whatever. So we'll just put that to one side.
No, but I mean, he was married to someone else at the time, but he was dating Linda Harrison, and he was clearly very determined to get her into this film, because in that early screen test, she's playing Zira.
Right.
That part obviously went to Kim Hunter, but he's like, no, my other missus is still going to be in this film. So Zanuck got his way, definitely.
Yeah.
That's more like it. Look at you tiptoeing around the juice. Oh, all the way from his bedroom, Chris Tilley. Yeah,
it can't be me that says it. It can't be, for obvious reasons. Right. I can hear it. I can accept it, but I can't. Okay. I can't go for her in that way. I know. It's not on brand at all.
It's not going for her. It's going for him, the sleaze.
I guess. Dr. Zaius was going to be played by Edward G. Robinson, who was in the screen test, but he backed out because of the makeup. So I really want to talk about the makeup designer, John Chambers, principally because I listened to a podcast last year called Wind of Change. Did you listen to this? So it was about CIA covert ops and propaganda, and it was about a rock song, Wind of Change, which you do know, and whether or not that was written by the CIA and helped to bring down the Soviet Union and all the rest of it. But John Chambers worked for the CIA creating disguise kits. And in the podcast Wind of Change, the podcasters talked to a woman who was on the team with John Chambers when he was part of, you know, the thing that Argo is based on. It's called the Canadian Caper.
Yeah.
So he was part of that. And she was talking about this makeup that they used. And all I'm thinking as a modern listener is like, oh, it's like fucking Mission Impossible, like the cool masks. And then she just drops these breadcrumbs and she's like, but the only reason I'm allowed to talk to you about the makeup that we were, you know, that we were designing in the 60s and 70s is because it's no longer of interest to the CIA. And when something is no longer of interest, you're allowed to talk about it. But what that also means is they're not using that technology anymore. They don't give a shit what you say about it because they've moved past it. So that to me was so cool because it's like they are using disguise techniques that you can't even imagine. Yeah.
Like nanobots. Nanobots that can change the structure of the face and the skin.
Yeah. She said she was her with John Chambers and his whole team. They would create makeup that was so convincing, but you know, one of the tests would be to walk into a room with your boss, excuse me, and convince him that you were someone else.
But what could it have been other than prosthetics back then? That's all it could have been.
I know, but yeah, but just very, very good ones. I mean, the monkey stuff is very good. So
it is.
Yeah, it's absolutely incredible. It's absolutely incredible. They had to invent like new rubber to make it for Planet of the Apes, to make it malleable enough that the actors could move, but it wasn't too heavy and all that. I mean, it is just amazing. Like, I think the makeup, I was wrong to let this pass me by based on, I was like, I wouldn't be able to sort of connect with that character because the makeup is incredible and it totally works. And without it, it's a very different and difficult proposition, I think.
Well, yeah, certainly.
Well, without it, they don't look like chimps. They look like
humans. Yeah, definitely, yeah. Then they just...
If they didn't have any makeup on it, it'd be the planet of the people.
No, but also, they've been more true to the spirit of the book, because I think it's fair to say that Tim Burton's fucking lady monkeys don't look much like monkeys, do they?
Hot.
Yeah, they look hot. You're not supposed to look like a hot lady.
You are if your lead is going to be in a relationship with one in a love triangle for most of the movie.
You don't have to do it that way. Like,
I think to make it palatable for a mainstream, we're doing Thursday already, but to make it palatable for a mainstream audience, yeah, Helena Bonham Carter's ape has to have a bob.
The bobs are God, let's just save it. Why have they all got such shit hair? All the lady monkeys have got shit hair, bad wigs. Anyway, that's all I've got. There's loads and loads.
There is.
I just wanted to like keep it concise.
Chris, you want to throw anything in?
Jerry Goldsmith did the music.
What is that now? Like 27 podcasts which Jerry Goldsmith featured on? He is way in the lead.
It's 12.
Right. How many?
And also, I made a list. Logan's Run, The Omen, The Swarm, Outland, Poltergeist, First Blood, Supergirl, Explorers, Legend, Leviathan, Warlock, Malice, The Shadow, Air Force One, Deep Rising, Small Soldiers, The Mummy, Hollow Man. We could do all of those and that'll get us up to 30.
Great.
Oh my God.
Challenge accepted.
There were like three movies on there that I really want to do, especially Deep Rising.
There was about 12 that I want to do, so we're good.
So
thank you, Jerry.
Thanks, Jerry. Thanks for the memories.
Thanks, Jerry.
Shall we talk about the film?
Fuck yeah.
Yeah. So bear in mind, first time viewer. So some of these, I've got some questions, such as...
All right, first time viewer as well. I've got no answers.
So let's meet George Taylor. He likes a cigar in space.
It's just brilliant.
Yeah. It's just like, I've got loads of questions. Like, he doesn't seem like a fucking astronaut at all, does he? And also, I will talk about his character, but he's taking five to lecture the people of Earth that he's on his way back to, and he's like, I bet you lot are fucking pretty shitty by the time I get home. Which I love as a character note, like, you've got no faith in humanity, but it's an odd choice for the leader of a space mission, I feel.
Yeah, they've been in space a while, haven't they?
Yes.
Yeah. So I think he's all like, I couldn't quite work it out. So he's heading back to an Earth 700 years.
Yeah, and he's already all right with that.
Yeah, which is kind of nuts in itself. But is he... So the plan was that they were going to head back to Earth, and Earth probably wouldn't be the Earth they remembered. Humankind might have died out, which is why Stuart was going to be the baby carrier.
That's what I think, yeah.
That was the plan. Right, yeah. Okay.
But they're quite chill. The plan to, you know, imagine yourself, not yourself, imagine the world in 700 years is unthinkable. 700 years is a long time. In a human brain, it's quite hard to parse the difference between 700 years and 2,000 light years. Just like, okay, it's just a big number now. Like, so
exactly.
What difference does it make?
And also, why would you not go, this could probably be Earth that we've landed on because it's 700 years in the future?
Exactly. So when they crash, there is a lot of dialogue, which is there for a good reason. They're fairly sure they're 2,000 light years from Earth. I think I could have done with a line that was like, on our big space adventure, we've actually come across quite a lot of planets with breathable air and gravity, for fucking starters. And they're 10 a penny. So there's nothing special about this place that makes, just to put you off the scent. But then am I thinking that because I know the ending? The characters don't know. I know. So it's like, well, it's really obvious that it's Earth. But, you know, if I didn't know the twist.
Yeah, I think if I was watching this cold for the first time without knowing the twist, there is enough there that makes me go, yeah, this is a different planet.
Yeah, nothing grows. And okay, yeah.
the little positioning of the tiny little stars and stripes, like they are a new planet and they're claiming it as their own.
Yeah.
It's nice.
So I love his attitude because it's really, Charlton Heston's attitude is really fun to watch, but there isn't much leadership. So he just belittles everyone. Like, he's like, stop fucking mourning. Like, yeah, you're miles away from home. And I love the speech that he gives to Landon about, oh yeah, there's a statue of you, yeah, and it's gone green now and no one can even tell what it is. But it's like, are you trying to motivate these people to march? Like, maybe just go a bit easy.
He's a real dick, a massive dick.
Yeah, I mean, just let your crew, let your colleagues, like, have a bit of a minute to take it in. But is it there? He is a chauvinist, obviously. He's an unreformed man. So the apes are right to fear him, yes? Because he represents a very base type of a man, as in human, not man as in gender man. Like, he's the worst kind of us kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So they're right to be worried about him.
Chris?
Yeah. And I think also it's setting up his hubris, isn't it? Because he's going to have a huge fall come the end of this film, and so it's starting right from the off. They're building him up to knock him down at the end, which makes it that much more powerful.
Yes. I get that. He's a white man who's had it relatively easy, and now that's going to do nothing for him later on. I get that.
I like the space backpacks. They look really uncomfortable, but they
look heavy,
cool.
Don't they? And they've got nothing useful in them, really.
No, I didn't really understand what all that equipment was. Have you got you brought the maracas, the space maracas? Great,
perfect. So they find a river. They meet the early humans, the mute humans. I mean, they wouldn't be mute as well. Like, early humans made noises. These guys don't really say much of anything.
I haven't read the book. Obviously, in the later films, the simian flu makes people mute.
Oh, okay.
Which is what caused the downfall of the planet in the first place.
I see. Because early humans did have language and singing and whoops and hollers.
But these aren't early humans.
What are they then?
These are post-apocalypse humans, aren't they?
But they used to, so they don't talk. Why do they not? All people communicate.
But because of the virus that wiped out a lot of the humans.
Okay.
The simian
flu. It's wiped out their vocal cords.
Yeah, it makes you mute.
Okay.
I don't know if that's... You see, this is where it all gets a bit weird, because that comes... For me, that comes from the most recent trilogy, which is in the final film, where the simian flu, humans are devolving, and therefore part of the devolution is they go mute and they can no longer communicate with speech.
All right.
But I don't know if that's canon for the original movies.
I see.
No, it's post-apocalypse, this story is, because the bomb's gone off.
Yes.
Yeah, but then towards the end of this franchise, it's all about, it's time travel, isn't it?
I'm talking about where these who these humans are, and they're post-apocalypse humans rather than sort of cavemen.
Yeah.
But the point is, at this this section of the film, I was like, this is all, like, I'm not quite sure what is going on, as in where I'm gonna find that thrill of, like, this is why this is revered as a great film.
Mm-hmm.
But then once the apes appear and start killing people, that's when I was into it.
Fantastic,
like, yeah. It's amazing.
Scary as well. I can imagine the first time you saw those apes appear in the cinema on horseback, because they're the scarier looking apes as well from the Ape Society.
Yeah.
And there's a real, I mean, I imagine, I got it a little bit watching it this time, but you're right. I'd sort of, after however long that walking around the desert is for half an hour, I was like, this is such a 1968 movie.
Yeah.
This is of that time.
Oh, modern. Oh, we're so childish. Just like, oh, because something needs to happen.
Yeah.
When you saw the scarecrows, I was like, oh, something's going to happen now. But it doesn't happen for ages after that. It feels like ages. It's not. We're just babies. But
yeah. But I do think, I think this also, I love a movie that is sort of, that sits outside the parameters of how a film is made now. And I love the idea that, you know, you've got half an hour of them walking, but I don't think it builds up enough of a surreal, ominous atmosphere as it could. And it's, you know, Charlton Heston just bitching at his crewmates, and you're like, I really feel that this moment could drag me into sort of this weird alien vibe of this planet. Is it Earth? Is it not Earth? And I just feel that they're fucking bored.
Also, were you disappointed that the scarecrows weren't corpses? Because I thought they were.
I couldn't work out what they were or what they signified.
It's literally scarecrows, just stuffed clothes.
Yeah, which is just a mark that that's the forbidden zone. Is that what we find out later on? Yeah. I thought, because you see them at a distance and they're set up like, this is going to be a big reveal. They're going to get up there and it's going to be flayed human skin hanging off them, and it's like, what's that?
It's just rags, like an actual scarecrow. Never mind. But the point, the political point that the film managed to make, obviously, very successfully, is having our humanity, the very worst of ourselves, reflected back at ourselves, which is the whole point of the exercise, with the apes standing over human corpses and having their photograph taken.
The trophy hunters, yeah.
Yeah, and it's so casual and it's so easy and it's harrowing. And I think it's much more shocking than anything in the other two films that we're going to talk about.
What, that one shot of them standing over the bodies of the humans?
And their friend taking a picture of them. Yeah, and the way that the bodies are piled up. And this is like 1968 and the, you know, notoriously, famously is a horrible word, but famously, the My Lai massacre had happened or been photographed. And so we deserve all of this and it's fucking horrible, but that's what we're like.
What did you think at this point, Chris? Were you enjoying the trudge through the desert? Did you see a lot of yourself in Charlton Heston?
I see more of myself in the apes, if I'm honest.
I mean, physically.
But that's just a physical thing.
Yeah, of course.
No, it's a bit, I mean, it's a bit slow, but obviously films moved at a different pace then. And I like the way it sets the mood, sets up the mood and the tone in a way that maybe, you know, Thursday's film, you jump in far too quickly. So, yeah, I think there's pros and cons to that, to the fact that it takes 30 minutes to get to the action. But I agree with Vicky, that photo. And I think the first word you hear one of them say is smile. Yeah. You know, that's dark. Yeah.
It is. So we're going to talk about the Ape Society, but let's have a short break.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember. Yeah,
you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, mate.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would think of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know.
And then we're way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
So the big point, Taylor discovers this world. Now, apes are the dominant group. So they talk, they use tools, they have law and order, they have religion, they have culture. Humans are mute, they are pets, or at best, at worst, they're experimented on. And the society has different levels depending on which ape you are. So gorilla, chimp, orangutan. He meets Dr. Zero, who gives him a pet name, Bright Eyes, and encourages him to speak. And I love the fact that he's desperate to talk, because to my reading, he's like, I'm a white guy. I can sort this out. Just let me talk because I could talk my way out of this situation. And he obviously, when he does not solve his problems in any way, which is good.
Yeah. Again, I'm a product of a certain generation of cinema goer. I'm like, hurry up and speak. We know you're going to take the bandage off at some point and speak. So just fucking hurry up. I get it. You got to play out this bit where it's like, da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. But I'm like, say something. I want to hear you speak.
Yeah.
It's slow.
And he's just lucky that he meets the right ape. So he meets Zira and her fiancé, Cornelius, and there's Dr. Zaius, but he appears to hate him and say that man is a nuisance and is only good for brain experiments. And he wants him to be gelded, which scared the shit out of me. Because I don't even have testicles. Mm. But just gelded, saying of a human person, you should be gelded, is fucked up. And it's really scary. And I did feel very bad for him.
Our second mention of losing your testicles on this episode.
Yeah, I know. About time. So Zira and Cornelius, brilliant, obviously. A slight gripe for me in that what's in front of them at this point of the film is our equivalent of a talking monkey from space, right? But they're pretty chill about that. Like, now they have their suspicions as to why he exists, but when you're watching at this point in the film, you don't know what their suspicions would be.
They don't necessarily think he's a talking monkey from space, though. They think he's, because they've got humans. It's not like he's an alien life form. They've got humans on the planet, and they are thinking this is an anomaly among the human species. I think it's the same if we came across a chimpanzee that could, you know, had rudimentary speech capabilities.
They don't have rudimentary speech capabilities, though. Like, if you went to the zoo and one went, hiya, you should be very scared because they can't do that. They can sign, but it's not the same.
Yeah.
It would scare you. And also, all these filmmakers know how much it would scare you because in The Rise of the Planet of the Apes, when Caesar finally speaks, it has... that has real power because they can't do that. And it's scary.
Yeah. All right. I get you. They do seem pretty chill, but I put that down to them just being super, like, intelligent and chill. Like, Zira is all like, yo, this is cool, you can speak.
Yeah, and they made they're like, oh, you're from space, are you? What are you like?
They're just like, you know, I think it makes them seem slightly more level-headed and less hysterical than him. It's a nice juxtaposition because he's like, come on, we've got to get out of here. And she's like, just chill, man. Like, we've got to go see Dr. Zaius.
That's a really good point because when he finally talks, do you want to do the line? So he finally talks and he's in the net and he insults them and he says...
Chris...
Take your hands off me.
No, babe, it's not that. It's take your stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape. But said like Charlton Heston. But this is a brilliant moment because he's cross. So he's basically naked. He's caught in a net. He hasn't got the fucking brains to try and charm his way out of it. He just shouts that he insults his captors, which is a crazy thing to do, but it fits for his character.
Yeah.
He should not be an astronaut. But it fits with his character that rather than being like, we can sort this out, he just insults the people that could kill him.
Yeah, because you got to imagine part of his journey out into space was to potentially meet alien species. You know, that must have been on the cards. They must have gone, look, chances are slim, but...
Just get ready.
This is let us just school you in how to approach... Get the fuck off me! Get out of your flippers touching me!
Yeah, you stink. Yeah, you're dirty. Like, that's not diplomacy.
You remember the octopus people we met on that water planet? And you were just like, eight? That's too fucking many. That didn't go well. So just, you know, chill with this sort of thing.
But it's why Zira and Cornelius work. Like you say, they're more level-headed. And he's just like, he goes through arcs and peaks and troughs with his character and he becomes more desperate. But in the moment where he could be like, guys, I appear to be caught in a net here, he's very rude. So he names this, you can imagine how I feel. But he names his pet woman, Nova, and bemoans, fucking whinges about Stuart checking out of being the new Eve. With his hot and eager help. And I just like...
Interesting language.
Yeah. Mm. I mean...
Very sort of... A little bit
too keen, I think.
Yeah, not very scientific. No. I think that's the weird thing. It's like, look, she, you know, this if this was
even
the plan,
if she'd signed up for it, she'd be like, can you at least pretend to not enjoy yourself?
This is just something we have to do.
We have to do.
Hot. Yeah, and that's eager. What I mean.
Like, can I just have 5 minutes?
That's just after he's told Nova that there were women, lots of women, lots of lovemaking.
There were women, so many women.
Before he says he reckons he loves her because, and I quote, you're the only girl in town.
Oh, yeah!
And then he teaches her to smile. I mean, it's just a bad 5 minutes for Charlton here.
Yeah. But let me be devil's advocate just for the thrill of it. Is he supposed to be a bad dude? So he's treating her as a pet. She's literally a human being, right? She might not be able to speak. She's not another species. She's not this, all these other stupid things you could say. She's literally a human, but he's treating her like an animal. So is he therefore awful? And meant to be awful. I'm not judging him.
Is he also seeing her as a science project because she's now his only chance to get procreation going again?
Yeah.
Is she a means to an end to him now? And that's why he's saying some of these things.
Well, I don't think he loves her, if that's what you're asking me. Like, definitely not.
Well, he does say that. Yeah. He does question if he loves her.
Yeah.
Self-awareness. That's a plus.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I just didn't know what I was supposed to think. I'm in 1968 and I'm like, oh, that's totally normal to talk to her like that. Or are you supposed to be the character of a bad man?
Oh, I see what you mean. Right. So taking into account the time period. Right. Go on, Chris.
I also think there's an element of him that they've set him up as having slightly lost his mind, I think. Do you not think on this space journey? A lot of the things he said, he seems deranged from the off. So, and that sort of, I think that fits in with what he's saying now. Yeah. So I think this stuff is shocking at any time.
Yeah. Did I read somewhere that, so she's got like a bra on for the whole thing, which I'm not saying she should take it off, but it's like an anachronism, like a sort of a civilization like that. I don't think they would necessarily feel the need to cover their breasts, but that it was just too much. You can't have a woman running around topless all the time in a film, but it is weird that of all the clothes she could make, she just made this like cute bra. Anyway, thank God she had it on, though, to be honest, otherwise I just would have exploded.
Would that not be just to support her if she's running around?
What, with an underwire? Like, she's learned metallurgy, but no, they haven't even got like the power of fire.
I mean,
I don't know.
What did prehistoric...
Nothing is what they wore.
Did they really wear nothing?
Why would they cover it up?
I mean, in 10 million years BC, 1 million years BC.
Yeah, but you'd have a whole thing on. You wouldn't have a bra shape on, would you? You'd have the same as everyone else, which would be a full covering.
Right.
Or when it was hot, you'd wear nothing.
I mean, all the movies I've seen...
Yeah, I know.
They've worn similar to what Nova wears in this. So I'm inclined to think that's a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah,
yeah, they went through the history books and cave paintings. And
most films are really well researched in this department. So I'm sort of going to go with actually the movies right. Just on this one.
Okay, yeah.
I still think Charlton Heston is a bit pushy. But, you know, I think she's wearing the appropriate outfit for the time period.
For the time period. So there's a very long courtroom scene here.
Are you going to talk about this bit at length? Because I don't, just don't direct any questions to me because I tuned out. I'm an idiot. But I was like, this feels important, like the movie's themes are being discussed. I'll just wait for Vicky to tell me what they are because, I'll just play on my phone while this bit's on. Because I'm at this point, I'm going, when's the Statue of Liberty turning up?
Yeah, when is it going to be a chase?
Right.
So what it is, it's good in terms of like the ethical, the moral questions, the implications about our perceived right, our perceived human right, that we have the, quote, divine spark to be able to do what we like on this planet. And then you place it in another context and you can see how false that is. And that's great. But it is a very, in film language, this is a very long conversation about stuff that we already know as the audience.
Right.
So there's definitely a place for it, but it's just you know, to modernize, it just felt very long, and it's slowing down the action.
I think it was probably quite important to the writer because Michael Wilson was blacklisted, and that's very much his political perspective here, in that by the end of the trial, Taylor realizes that his case was preordained and he never had a chance. And so I think that's Michael Wilson. You know, it was tough for blacklisted writers to put their point across. And so I think he does it quite elegantly here. It's just obviously, I agree. It does take a while to get there.
And Pierre Boulle, the writer of the book, when he went to Indochina and he apparently he's working for the Free French and he's meant to infiltrate like a Vichy controlled area. And on a whim, he just told the truth to an officer that he thought would be sympathetic. So they're both French. And he was just like, look, I'm here to do this, but can you help me out? Because this Vichy thing, it's not cool. So I can sense from you that you might come over to my side. And he was like, fuck you, you're off to prison. And he spent like 2 years in a forced labor camp. So that influence Pierre Boulle's writing, because you can think you're on the right team and another dude's just like, sorry, no, you're not. And you think you have a commonality, like an underlying humanity, like we're both French, we both got this, like, no.
So, shit spy.
I mean, yeah.
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 So I'm a spy, but do you know what would be quicker? I just tell you that I'm a spy and you're going to hell. I'm in jail.
That didn't work. Most jails full of spies that were like, God, did you just try telling them? Yeah, shit.
Same guy. Guy with the hair and the moustache. Yeah. He seems so nice,
isn't he? Yeah.
He was like, tell me your problems.
He's a fucking sneaky one. Yeah. Yeah.
Good spy, though. Better than us.
Where is he now?
He's out there having a ball. We're in this forced labour camp. God, you live and learn.
So to flip from the courtroom scene, which is a long conversation about stuff we already know, we then go and have a long conversation with Zaius, which is stuff that we know isn't true. So I love, you know, the acting's amazing and the moral content is fantastic. But I was like, oh, I know that Taylor isn't a mutant and he doesn't have a nest of women and all the rest of it.
Yeah, but so I'm confused here because it seems like Dr. Zaius, later on in the film, it seems like he knows all along that Earth was Earth, like that they have overtaken humanity and that the Forbidden Zone is actually full of the old civilization of mankind that has fallen and that, you know, the apes have taken over. So at this point, I'm like, what are you doing? Like, do you think he's a mutant or do you know? I'm confused.
I was confused. But the point was his character, it's a good scene. His character shifts. You know, it's like I've been sort of ragging you this whole time, but actually I sort of know exactly what's going on. Mm. And I believe you kind of thing.
Right.
I thought. But then anyway, it doesn't matter because Taylor's going to break out and then demands that the woman comes. I want her. And then she gets dragged along for the ride to the Forbidden Zone. So do you feel like the surprise is overly telegraphed here or not? Because they're looking for evidence. So Cornelius and Zira and Charlton Heston and Nova along for the ride are looking for evidence of an earlier society, because this evidence of an early society will exonerate Zira and Cornelius. In terms of plot, unless that, like, do you care if Zira and Cornelius get absolved and get to go home? You don't care, do you? Like, who cares?
I mean, if I can refer to my answer earlier.
You were on your phone.
I'm just waiting for the Statue of Liberty at this point. I'm like, I want to see that bit and I want to see how I feel about that bit. I'm not really sure what's going on. Is that what was happening? Is it about getting Cornelius and Zira off the hook? Or
yeah.
I mean, I don't know. Just give Charlton a gun and have him shoot a few things.
Well, exactly. So who cares? So they find this doll that says mummy or mama. And
good point about the batteries, by the way. Never thought of that.
Yeah, but then the Tim Burton one's like, oh, it's nuclear. So, if you'd seen that one first, you'd be like, oh, it's just a nuclear doll. That's fine. But at the time, you're just like, there's no way that fucking AAAs are lasting 800 years, obviously.
So you think that before humanity collapsed and the nukes went off, they
put uranium in a doll?
They started using nuclear power to power a doll to say, mama.
I
did like the line where he goes, why, when Dr. Zaius is like, I've seen apes with dolls like this. And yes. Charlton Heston does go, but why, if why humans can't talk why would they make a doll that talks? Yeah. I was like, oh, that's nice.
Yeah, good point.
Where's the Statue of Liberty now?
Yeah.
Chris, what did you think?
Yeah, no, I love it. The mama is, and that point that he makes is one of the best bits in the film.
But if there are doll monkeys that speak, because children like toys that are cute, but they also like toys that talk. So you can buy a talking monkey toy now. It doesn't prove the existence of.
Yeah, I don't think you can.
Yeah, right. Okay.
No, honestly, have you ever bought Marshall or anyone else?
A talking monkey, probably. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, and it might say mummy. I think. I don't know. I just
it sounds vague.
It does sound a bit wishy-washy.
No, you'd know if you had a talking monkey doll in the house.
Would I?
Yeah.
Would I?
I don't think you can buy them.
Okay.
I think the point the film makes
is sound.
It's very, very good. Chris, I'm sure you agree. There's no such thing as an animal doll that actually speaks human words, because that's blasphemy.
Yeah. And the point is it says mama, isn't it, as well? a human doll that says mama.
You can get a monkey to say mummy. Anyway.
You just said a minute ago monkeys can't talk.
A doll one.
All right.
A toy one.
Okay. It's just fear. I feel like you've taken a confusing part of the film and made it more confusing rather than adding clarity to this.
Yeah.
It's fine though. It's cool.
I think the point he was making is why would they make a monkey doll to say mama?
Yeah.
A human doll.
Human doll. Yeah. Yeah, I know. So
I don't think you do. Let's go back. I don't think we've covered this doll enough.
Let's not.
Right.
So let's talk about the kiss, because it's kind... What's fine, I guess.
Which kiss?
So he kisses before everyone rides off to find their destiny kind of thing.
Oh, they're like, okay, bye. Zero.
And then he's like, we're going this way. You guys, you're going to shoot off now? Well, we're going the other way. Don't worry, we're getting the Northern Line. So... bye. They sort of orchestrated this kiss with Zero, which is really innocent, but you don't need to do that. So I would say that any sort of sexual... there's no sexual tension here. In the other film, there's fucking tons of it. It's so weird. But in this film, she's engaged. She likes her human because he's interesting, but I don't feel like she's attracted to him. And I think the kiss was just something that she wanted to do just to see what it was like. What do you think?
I don't know. I think if you've been helped... if I was helped by, a chimpanzee in the real world. I kiss Simon all the time, my dog.
On the lips? Do dogs have lips?
Still with one species at a time. Let's stick with the chimpanzees at the moment. But yeah, dogs have lips. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Why is... Chris, step in here. Vicky's gone. She's... the idea of whether a dog has lips or not is we're in one of those situations. Break the glass. Step up. Come on, Chris.
I'm sorry.
Isn't it partly there so that she can say, all right, but you're so damned ugly?
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So we've spent the film marvelling at how weird these apes look, and maybe not thought about the fact that actually they think we're really ugly. And that's not the audience hasn't considered that until this point.
And that's it. He finally finds the Statue of Liberty, and he suddenly becomes extremely emotional. I mean, he's been emotional so far, but my point is, he is not a person that believes in human goodness. Taylor is not. Taylor is like on the communique before they get to Earth. He's like, you're fucking ruined it, I reckon. And then when they get on the planet, he's like, there's got to be something better than man. He says that almost word for word. Mm-hmm. So he doesn't believe in human goodness. So why is he surprised that the Earth has gone to shit?
Oh, come on. You cannot believe in human goodness and still be like, fuck me. Like, I mean, you know, you might be saying that, like, I'm a cynic, but like, I say it, but I don't, I say it in a way that I hope I'm wrong.
Okay.
You know, like, you see, you do a worst case scenario, but you never really believe it. You think people will come through. And so he's been going, yeah, fuck humankind, fucking dickheads now. But I think deep down, he wouldn't actually think, oh my God, this is Earth.
Okay.
And you actually totally fucked it.
Yeah, that's a good explanation. Because to me, he's like, oh, I bet you fucked it all up. And it's like, yeah, they have.
Yeah.
So... but I didn't sort of see that.
I think I agree with you, Vicky, but I think it's an example as well of you don't know what you got till it's gone. And I think they've been building that up as well.
If he's going to get away sort of scot-free and he's got a pet human who he's quite happy to just treat as some sort of, as a sex slave, as long as he can find enough to eat, it's a pretty sweet life.
And there are other humans around. So, and he could probably eventually teach them to talk.
Yeah. Right,
exactly. I honestly think I'm sort of like, you know.
Seems all right.
He's not in the worst situation. I don't watch this and feel really bad for him.
No.
Because he wasn't going anywhere anyway. If it turned out that this wasn't Earth and he wasn't another planet, he's not going home. He's got no spaceship or anything. Mm. So he's stuck there. It's sort of like, oh, it is Earth. All right.
Yeah.
Come on, Nova.
But it's a cool twist, obviously, and it looks amazing. And it still looks amazing for its time. Like, it looks good.
Yeah.
Do you not think so?
It's not as good as Mega Maid sticking out the sand in Spaceballs, because I saw that before I saw this.
Do you want to hear some alternate endings which were written at the time?
Yes.
So, first one, Taylor escapes with Nova, flies home to Earth, which is inhabited by apes. There you go. Another one, the apes...
escapes with Nova, flies home to Earth. So it's the same ending as Tim Burton?
Yeah.
All right.
Then another ending, the apes plan to explain everything that Taylor and Zero and Connors have uncovered using a robot resembling Taylor to sort of come out and go, yeah, no, nothing to see. Sorry about that. Fun. And then the last...
playing into Dr. Zaius's theory. And
yeah. So they're going to make a robot, even though they don't seem to have any tech.
Camera is the most advanced tech they've got, a camera.
Oh, yeah. And then this one, which is fun. I really like this one. So Taylor escapes to his ship with Cornelius and Zira, and they discover what is described in the script, to sort of not ruin the surprise, as a metal arm sticking out of the sand. Then they finally realise, so they can hear aircraft overhead, like the monkeys are coming to get them, they finally realise where they are as the arm sort of becomes more revealed and it's the Statue of Liberty. The gorillas arrive, shoot him dead. So what you've seen on screen is Taylor's face being like, oh my God, you haven't seen it as the audience. The gorillas shoot him dead. They carry his corpse away. And as they carry his corpse away, the camera pans around to reveal the Statue of Liberty.
That's an ending.
Yeah, it's fucking awesome, isn't it?
Dark as hell, but I'd love that. I'd walk away from this movie going, fuck.
Yeah, it's great. Because he was also about to escape as well, so it's got all your elements there. Yeah, it's good, isn't it?
That's suitably bleak.
Yeah.
Good, yeah, I like it.
And that's it. So I don't have any more. So would you like to do the bits, or would you like to chuck anything else in?
Well, let's ask the author of this Triple Threat Week. Chris, anything to add?
No, let's go for
Brilliant.
It.
Brilliant. All right.
Let's go for
Chris,
it.
What was your best scene?
Ending.
Yeah. Alex?
The end, or the first time the apes ride in on horseback. I genuinely found that quite affecting.
Yeah, I would say the ending, but actually they're posing over the bodies and they're saying smile, because everything this film is saying is encapsulated in that one moment. And it's saying a lot and it says it a lot brilliantly throughout the film, but it's all in that moment, which is good. What's your most valuable whatever, Alex?
I like Roddy McDowall as Cornelius.
Do you?
Oh yeah, I don't know why. There's something about, obviously they're all acting past the makeup, but I get the most personality of any of the apes from Roddy McDowall as Cornelius. I sort of, there's a, you know, his frustration with Zira and like his love for Zira. I get most of their chemistry from his end.
They're quite cute, aren't they?
I like them as a couple. I mean, yeah. I'd have them round. Yeah. I mean, and I don't do that a lot.
He's the actor who worked with the makeup artist to figure out how he could do little twitches on his mouth.
Oh.
And I think that brings the character to life in a way that some of the other apes aren't quite as realistic. Yeah. So he knew what he was doing.
Mm. What's yours, Chris?
I'll go John Chambers.
Yeah.
He did an amazing job. There wasn't an Oscar for makeup back at this period, but he received a special Academy Award for achievement for this film. So yeah, he's done a great job.
He is also mine. It's incredible what was achieved.
He's also mine.
Brilliant. So what would you change, Alex?
So, controversial, sure. Interesting, definitely. What you do, the Statue of Liberty at the end. Picture that.
Yep. Put some pink slime in it.
No, don't go Ghostbusters 2, although great.
Thanks.
Love the Ghostbusters reference. No. What you do a George Lucas on this motherfucker, all right? What you do is you get your CGI digital tools out and you put General Thade's face on the Statue of Liberty at the end of the 1968 version and bang, suddenly it's a shared universe with 2001's Planet of the Apes. It's not a reimagining. Thade is in this as well.
Okay. I can't really keep up with that, but that sounds cool.
It makes more sense in the end of 2001's Planet of the Apes, trust me.
Chris, what would you change?
I would get rid of a character you didn't even mention. Just completely wipe him out. Lucius. Is he the nephew?
Oh,
of,
yeah, because he's so annoying.
He's annoying and he's pointless. Yeah. He's there so that Taylor can make these weirdly contradictory points about youth culture that don't really fit in with what his attitude seems to be. And so just get rid of him and Cornelius can happily do everything that he does.
Oh, I've got another moment that I loved. Remember when Dodge, his fellow astronaut, gets shot in the back of the head when the monkeys arrive, the apes arrive in the first raid. And then when Charlton's running around the museum trying to escape the apes and he runs past John Dodger's embalmed corpse, he gets shot in the back of the head again with the body. After he's dead and embalmed, he gets shot in exactly the same way. I thought that was quite funny.
It's awful. It's mean.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, why would you do that? Why would you have him shot twice in the back of the head?
Do you want to know what my change is?
Mm.
I think Taylor, although it undoes, I mean, maybe you can't even have Charlton Heston in it if this is how it's going to be. But he's the sort of man who thinks he's good, right? and he's looking forward to going home and seeing how awesome future Earth is, but being stripped of everything, all of his privilege, and it brings out the worst in him. So his treatment of Nova should be like a gradual slide. Like, he wouldn't talk to her like that at first, kind of thing. Wouldn't talk to her like she was a pet or an animal. But then when he realizes he could get away with it, because he's not going to be judged for acting like an animal because they think he's an animal, right? So when he realizes he can get away with it and he's under a lot of stress, like the situation, it pushes him to do things he would never normally do. And that despite everything, he's doomed to be a bastard because we're all doomed to be fucking awful. And that's the sort of emotional mix going on.
He starts to devolve like the humans that he's surrounded by and starts behaving like them.
Yeah. In the absence of a morality that can hold him accountable to be the best possible human, which is kind of the point of law and order and culture and whatever else, he just debases himself pretty quickly because he can, and he will get away with it, and because the situation pushes him to do it, kind of thing.
He's kind of got it quite good on this planet, you know.
Yeah. Well, he says that, doesn't he, at some point? He's like, oh, they don't speak, so we're going to be bossing this shit like in no time. That's it. We're done.
Cool, cool, cool. Chris, do you want to do a quiz this week, or do you want to save it for next week when we're back together?
Let's save it for Thursday.
Lovely.
All right, then. All right, like it. All right, then. So we'll save the clue for Thursday for next week as well, seeing as we've got three shows, unless you want to do your clue now, V.
It's up to you. I've got a clue.
All right, do a clue.
Are you ready?
Yep.
Congratulations on your little monster.
Oh, that's good. I like that. All right, that's the clue for next week's movies. But before then, it's Triple Threat Week. We are back Thursday as Chris takes us on the wild ride that is Tim Burton's 2001 reimagining. And then on Saturday, I'll be taking us through 2011's Rise of the Planet of the Apes. In the meantime, please subscribe, rate, and review us if you have the time. It's a great help. And check in with us on Twitter and Instagram at ClashPod. Back on Thursday. Bye-bye.
This was a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that? I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.